connected now, folks. Well, I thank you very much for this completely unexpected present. I'd like to know how comets are necessary, but how comets are necessary, I already didn't get it. Some of my jokes are meteors and others. Strange thing that's always amazed me about comet cleanser is that despite the name, it contains no ammonia. I don't really understand. Okay, tonight, as Ray suggested, this lecture is about moons, the moons of Jupiter, primarily the four large or planet-sized ones, the Galilean satellite. If I have time at the end, which I doubt, because I always have more to say than I have time to say it in, I will try to tell you what little we learned about the small moons of Jupiter from the Voyagers as well. But the big moons were, and you've got to realize, when I say moons, these are full-sized planets in their own right. All four of them are bigger than Pluto, two of them are bigger than Mercury. And they turned out from the Voyagers to be very, very different from each other, and very, very different from any of the bodies that we knew in the inner solar system, the so-called terrestrial planets in the inner solar system. In other words, the ones that we had been exploring in space exploration up to this time. And in our inner solar system chauvinism, many people may have thought of them as normal. In fact, they are not. For example, it is not normal for a world, by world I mean either moon or planet, and these are planet-sized bodies, and I'll undoubtedly end up calling them planets tonight, even though by strict definition they're not. As far as size is concerned, they are. It is not normal for any body to be made of rock. And, you know, we tend to assume it is because we live on one of the rare exceptions. So, if we can have the slides, the lights out. This is a picture which gives you an illustration, another illustration of these fantastically powerful Voyager telescopic cameras. This picture was taken in December of last year from 270 million miles away in the asteroid belt. The spacecraft wasn't. This is a picture. And you can see Jupiter up there. That is not the Great Red Spot. That's the defect in the image. And you can also see the four Galilean satellites, which are called that because they were discovered by Galileo in 1610 with History of Church Astronomical Telescope, and their names are Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto, and I named them in order outward from the planet. In this picture, it looks as though Europa is closer than Io. That's because Europa, you know, there's a second, third dimension to the sky, which you can't see in the picture, and Europa is either just about to pass in front of Jupiter here, so it's way in front of Jupiter, or just about to pass behind it, I don't know which. The pronunciation of Io is up to you. If you want to pronounce it Io, as I understand it, that is considered an acceptable anglicization. Io is apparently closer to what the ancient Latins would have said. Those, of course, are the people who spoke ancient Latin. And so, you know, I tend to use that, but if you want to say Io, go right ahead. The other things that you see in the picture, particularly that is not Amalthea, the small moon of Jupiter, that is closer to Jupiter than the only small moon that is closer than the four big ones. And these things here are just at the very first in the picture. So, now that you have been introduced to them from a distance of 270 miles, you know pretty much what we knew about them before Voyager 1 got there. And we had the incredible experience of having the entire world pass suddenly from this kind of knowledge, where we simply dot the light in our best telescopic pictures and the Voyager pictures, pass suddenly into a situation where we now have pictures of most of their surfaces in at least the detail that we have in the best Earth-based pictures of our own moon. And you literally had the entire world suddenly becoming known in the space of a couple of hours each. So it was, well, a few hours each. It was a truly remarkable experience. It was a fantastic thing to be there. I think it is truly tragic that the commercial television networks did not feel that was important enough to give it to you live. For that matter, to give it to you delayed. But they didn't. Well, in any case, I'll try to make up for that. Now, first I want to try to tell you what these bodies are made of, and this is the best slide I could think of to illustrate the point that I want to make, and the problem is there's some errors in the slide. Ceres is the largest asteroid in sequence outward from the Sun. It ought to be in between Mars and Jupiter. However, the artist has drawn it way too big. Ceres is only 500 miles across. At this scale, it wouldn't even show. For some reason, the Galilean satellites are shown in opposite order. That's Io, that's Europa, that's Ganymede, and that's Callisto. I can tell from their sizes. There are two, otherwise though, aside from the fact that Pluto is way too big, but that's not the artist's fault. That's only been learned in the last couple of years. But, and this diagram was drawn a bit before that. other than that, it's pretty much accurate. And it certainly shows you that there are three very different kinds of objects in the solar system. There is a sun, which is a star, which is enormous compared to anything else. It makes up 99.5% of the 2 billion tons that comprise the solar system. Then there are the Jovian planets, which make up almost all the rest. Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Jovian planets are very large compared to terrestrial planets, which is the third type, although they are small compared to a star, and they are made mostly of hydrogen and helium, and after that, the compound of hydrogen with the compounds of hydrogen with each of the next most abundant materials in the universe, and those are oxygen, carbon, and nitrogen, and the major compounds of hydrogen with each of those are water, methane, and ammonia, respectively. Water, I assume you all know about. Methane you know about too, but perhaps not under that name. It can be produced by biological processes on the Earth, and in fact most of the what little methane we have on the Earth was produced by biological processes, so it is a gas that is in the bubbles that you see coming up out of the ooze in a swamp as a result of organic decomposition down there, or it's the gas you cook with, and there it was produced by decomposition of older organic material underground, fossilized material, in the same way as oil was formed. But methane can also be produced by non-biological processes, and it is a very common substance in the universe. Ammonia, so-called ammonia, household ammonia, is actually ammonia gas dissolved in water. And so if you imagine evaporating out the water and having a gas left, which would not be a terribly pleasant experience to do in your kitchen, but if you imagine doing such a thing, then that gives you an idea of what ammonia gas is. Water is H2O, that is a molecule made of one atom of hydrogen and two of oxygen. Methane is CH4. It's the simplest of the many, many compounds that hydrogen and carbon can form, and therefore the most common in the universe. And CH4 means there's one carbon atom and four hydrogen atoms, and ammonia is NH3, one nitrogen and three hydrogen. So, now that you know all about those substances, that is what most of Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus and Neptune are made of. There are arguments over whether Uranus and Neptune have a whole lot of hydrogen and helium left over, or whether they're mostly water, methane, and ammonia. Probably they have a fair amount of hydrogen and helium, because hydrogen and helium are so abundant in the universe. 99% of the atoms that make up the universe are hydrogen and helium, that a body can be made mostly of hydrogen and helium, lose the majority of its hydrogen and helium, and still be made mostly of hydrogen and helium, just because there is so much more hydrogen and helium to start with than anything else. The difference basically between a Jovian planet and a terrestrial planet is that the Jovian planet was massive enough, back when the solar system was forming 4.6 billion years ago, that as it formed, as the region of gas and dust in the cloud of gas and dust around the solar system, the region where it happened to be was condensing under its own gravity, collapsing to form the planet. The planet was able to suck in all of the material that was there, or at least much of the material that was there, irrespective of whether it was a solid or a gas. And I put it that way because liquids would not have existed at that low pressure in the dust and the gas and dust cloud. And so, since most of the material in the cloud of gas and dust was hydrogen and helium, if you had a body that was heavy enough to be able to incorporate those things into itself, had enough gravity to be able to do that, then you are going to get a Jovian planet. Why all the Jovian planets are in the outer part of the solar system is not clear. After all, there are only four of them, so that's not a terribly big number. Maybe it's just coincidence. But it's also possible that for some reason, the fact that they were farther from the sun and therefore colder, and therefore each one had a larger region of solar nebula to draw on, and all these things, solar nebula is the term for the cloud of gas and dust the solar system formed from, that may be the reason why the Jovian planet formed out there, or it may be it's just coincidence and we find another solar system that's just like ours, except you got a Jovian planet in where Mercury is in ours, you know, we just can't tell. Terrestrial planets, on the other hand, had gravities that were small enough. For example, the Earth's gravity is very small because the Earth is such a puny object, a mere 6 sextillion tons of rock and metal, that its gravity was not able to hold the hydrogen and helium. Even as the Earth was forming, 99% of the matter that was trying to form into it was escaping into space, and that included not only the hydrogen and helium, but in fact, the Earth's gravity and the gravities of the other terrestrial planets were not able to hold any substance that was not solid at their particular distance from the sun. And thereby hangs an interesting tale, because some substances that were solid farther out in the solar system at the same time were not solid closer in where the sun was shining more strongly because you were closer to the heat source. And so you have the interesting situation that terrestrial planets are made of radically different substances at different distances from the sun. And we can see that in what they're made of today. Now, when I say terrestrial planets, I'm using the term broadly. Sometimes terrestrial planets are used by astronomers just to mean the rock planets, and I don't know what they would call the Galilean satellites. I am going to use the term tonight to mean any body of planetary size which is not a Jovian planet. In other words, any body which is made only of those substances that happen to be solid at that body's particular distance from the sun in the solar nebula, without regard to whether the body revolves directly around the sun or, as in the outer solar system, revolves around the Jovian planet. A lot of astronomers don't really seem to think of it that way, and they go through this thing about why is it that all the terrestrial planets form the inner solar system and all the Jovian planets form the outer solar system? That's not so. Terrestrial planets formed in both places. There are plenty of terrestrial planets out here. It's just that in the outer solar system, they revolve around the even larger objects, the Jovian planets, that formed out there at the same time and did not form in here. And there is one terrestrial planet the Earth has not drawn, and that is the big moon of Neptune, which is called confusingly Triton. Don't confuse Titan, the big moon of Saturn, with Triton, the big moon of Neptune. And Triton is possibly the biggest moon in the solar system, it may be the size of Mars. That's a fairly recent finding, and we're not sure. We just don't know which is the biggest. And that's kind of ironic, because all through this century, Ganymede and Titan have been fighting it out for the title of biggest moon in the solar system. And every time somebody determined a more accurate diameter for one or the other, one or the other would pull ahead, and then somebody would get a better diameter for the other, and that would pull ahead, and so forth. And it looks as though now the race may go to a dark horse that nobody even thinks about very much, Triton, which is sort of strange. Yeah. Let me talk about life in this solar system, huh? Because this is the only place where we know anything about the planets. I can't imagine life on any of the on any of the satellites of any of the Jovian planets that we know. A few months ago, I would have said Titan was a good candidate. As you'll see next week, it is now not. So the Jovian planets sort of win there by default just because we know less about them. But, you know, as I mentioned last week, you have real problems with life in Jupiter because although the temperatures and pressures are reasonable, and you have the basic substances, methane, ammonia, and water out of which life is believed to have formed on the Earth, and you have lightning to serve as a powerful energy source, not to mention all the planet's internal heat, you also have, because of that internal heat, a great deal of convection in the atmosphere, a great deal of vertical motion, which would do a nice job of taking organic molecules that formed where the temperature was reasonable and carrying them down into a place where it was so hot that the temperature was unreasonable. So that's the best I can tell you. But listen, any question that I'm asked about life outside the solar system, including do I think it exists, the only answer I can give is we know so little. There are so many things that we would have to know to answer that question, or even to put a probability on it, that in fact we don't know, that I think it is a very bad mistake for an astronomer even to try to put a probability on it at this current fragmentary state of our knowledge. We don't know how common planets are. We don't know how common Earth-type planets are. We don't know how likely it is for life to develop on a planet, given the conditions might be suitable. We don't know how likely it is that life would continue to exist on that planet, given the conditions are suitable and given that it did develop. In other words, we don't know whether the conditions might change and wipe it out. And then if you want intelligent life, you've got a whole series of subsidiary questions, like we don't know how likely it is for intelligent life to develop. Certainly, it's been a very, very recent thing in the history of life on this planet. You know, there's only been intelligent life on this planet for much less than the last 0.1% of the age of the planet. So I realize astronomers far more eminent than I, and some that I admire deeply in many respects, Carl Sagan is an obvious example that comes to mind, have gone so far as to come out and put themselves on record in saying life is probably common in the universe. And I think that's a very, very bad mistake. I think it's an extrapolation of a very important finding from very, very insufficient database. You know, in a few years we'll begin to answer some of those questions. The space telescope will begin to tell us whether other stars have planets, for example. But at this point, I just wouldn't want to talk about it. I hope you don't go home thinking that you've heard me say that I don't think there's life in the universe. The problem is that's one of those questions that seem to be so important to people that they seem to need an answer for it so badly that they seem to be willing to invent an answer for themselves for their own peace of mind, even in the absence of evidence. And I think that is what people like Carl Sagan, in all honesty, are nevertheless doing to themselves. And I've found from experience that if I say what I just said, a lot of the audience goes home thinking they heard me say that I don't think that life is common in the universe. That's not the answer they wanted, but at least it's an answer, you know. And I'm asking you to accept something that's much harder than that, namely that we don't know and that we can't put any sort of reasonable probability on. Question down here. Now, I don't think that's a change in his viewpoint. That's been pretty obvious all along, and I think he would have said that was pretty obvious all along. But he has been going around maintaining it was probably very common, and I just don't think you can say that. Oh, I know the argument. You know, suppose life is so rare that only one star in a million has planets that have life on them. Then just in our galaxy, there are so many stars that there would be 200,000 planets that 200,000 stars of that sort. Yeah, sure, that's true. So what? One in a million happens to be a standard English phrase. It has no scientific significance. So it's one in a trillion. Then in one galaxy out of every four to the size of ours, you would have one such star. So it's one in a quintillion. So it's one in ten. I'm telling you, we don't know. Well, let me go back to terrestrial planets and what they are. Terrestrial planets, then, are the ones who are made only if things were solid, and they're part of the solar nebula. Well, it turns out that when the planets were forming, the Sun was going through its T-Tauri stage. That is an early phase in the life history of a star, which it goes through for a brief time, about 1% of what its total lifetime is going to be. In the case of the Sun, since its total lifetime is about 10 billion years, about halfway through that 10 billion years now, I'm talking about the T-Tauri phase having lasted about 100 million years, and we think the planets forming considerably less than that time, so that works out okay. The T-Tauri stage is named for a star that is doing it now, that is in the final stages of being born at this present time. And there are several hundred T-Tauri stars known in the sky. Well, the T-Tauri stage is one in which the star is several hundred to several thousand times brighter than it is going to be a little bit later when it settles down and becomes a normal, well-behaved, what is called a main sequence star, such as the Sun is today and such as it has been for 4.5 billion years. And in the T-Tauri stage, the Sun, and therefore the solar nebula around it, was a great deal hotter at every point than the corresponding locations are today. The proof of that came in 1973, when Mariner 10 became the first spacecraft to visit Mercury, and, among other things, it measured the interior densities of Mercury, the ways we talked about for Jupiter last time. And it turns out that Mercury, although everybody's first reaction when they see the Mariner 10 pictures is it looks just like the Moon, by which they mean, duh, it's covered with craters. So is any airless world, but at least any airless world that doesn't have other geologic processes to destroy the craters. However, that's ironic because that moon-like cratered exterior is only a thin shell a few hundred miles deep, and virtually the entire planet is an enormous core of iron and other metals, which make up 80% of the planet. Mercury is basically a 3,000-mile ball bearing with a thin shell of rock on the outside. And apparently the reason for this is very simply that the Sun was so hot when the planets were forming 4.6 billion years ago that 36 million miles away from the Sun where Mercury was forming, rock was gaseous. And the only substances that were solid and therefore that could form into a terrestrial planet were the metals. And so they formed this huge iron core, and it was only toward the end of the several millions to several tens of millions of years that it took for Mercury to accrete that a thin shell of rock, presumably the highest boiling point rock, were able to form outside that ball-bearing exterior. Twice as far out, and therefore one quarter as intense sunlight, Venus, one point four times farther out, and therefore half as intense sunlight, where Venus was forming 72 million miles away. That is quite far out. All right, I'll have to go through the numbers sometime. Anyway, far enough out for Venus, rock was solid, but Venus has very much less water than the Earth does. And remember I promised when we were talking about Venus to explain more about why it didn't have water when we got to the moons of Jupiter, of all things. Well, now you begin to see why I wanted to do that. And this is something that I'm adducing as evidence that, in fact, Venus never had much water. Suggestive evidence, not proof, certainly. But it suggests that Venus may never have had anything like as much water as the Earth, rather than once having had it and lost it. Earth, you know what it's made of, but I want to point out that Earth also is very water deficient compared to the universe as a whole. It's not as water deficient as Venus. But if you look at the kinds of atoms that make up water, namely hydrogen and oxygen, and compare them with the kinds of atoms that make up the commonest rocks, you will find that Earth has lost almost all of its water. It was gaseous when the Earth was forming, and so it boiled off, and the Earth has only a relatively small amount of this stuff, which if we had as much of it as the percentages of the amount of rock that we had, if you look at cosmic abundances and figure out how much water we ought to have too, the water on this planet ought to outweigh the rock about 3 times. And obviously it does not. I got this far once in the lecture, and somebody raised their hand and said, but isn't 3/4 of the Earth covered with water? And the answer is yes, 3/4 of the Earth's surface is covered with water, but that is a very, very tiny volume compared to the interior volume of all that rock. It's just that such water as we do have has mostly made its way to the outside because it's a relatively lightweight material, and the Earth is differentiated. Mars is also made of rock, but it is apparently, this is controversial, but there is evidence that Mars is more rich in water. There's more water per cubic mile on Mars than there is in the Earth. Then to get to the next terrestrial planet, you've got to go 3 times farther out from the Sun than Mars. That gap, of course, is not shown you, but you do. And remember, I'm not talking now about Jupiter. Jupiter is a Jovian planet. These considerations that I'm going through don't apply. It's made of everything in the cosmic proportion. And indeed, in Jupiter, the water outweighs the rock by a factor of 3. But what I'm talking about is the Galilean satellite. I'd like to talk for the moment just about the outermost, Callisto. Callisto is, in fact, made mostly of water, probably mostly in the frozen forest. It's basically a 3,000-mile snowball. It has some rocky material, about 1/4 of it is rock, and that rocky material appears to be uniformly mixed through Callisto, and so you have some of it on the outside. On the very outside, meteorite impacts, small meteorite impacts, have vaporized the ice preferentially compared to the rock. At least this is what we think happened, because there's a weird sort of paradox here. Callisto's surface is made almost entirely of some unknown, very dark rock. And you see very little water. You see no water. You see very little water, very little frozen water when you look at the spectra of Callisto. Not going to talk about what the other two Galilean satellites are made of for a moment. Titan appears to be made of a mixture of frozen water and frozen ammonia. And remember, ammonia also is a substance that would be more common than rock if you are in a region of the solar nebula where it was cold enough that ammonia could freeze. And that takes a temperature of around 200 degrees below 0 Fahrenheit. We know very little about what Triton is made of. It appears to have some sort of non-icy surface, at least. That's all we can say. But the betting is that it's probably made inside of a mixture of frozen water, frozen methane, and maybe, frozen ammonia, and maybe frozen methane as well. Methane is more common than ammonia, but in the cosmos, but it freezes at a lower temperature, so you probably do not have it in Titan. We do have a measurement of how heavy Titan is from Pioneer 11, and its density is not that of rock. It's definitely that of frozen water, or frozen ammonia, or frozen methane. All those things have about the same density, but we don't have any such data for Titan. And Pluto? Well, of course, we know even less about Pluto, but we do know from spectroscopic observations that at least its surface is made... I shouldn't say we know less about Pluto than Triton. That's not true. We know that its surface is partially made of frozen methane. Now you're at a temperature below 400 degrees below zero. And we also know, since Pluto has a moon now, was discovered last year, that we can measure how heavy it is, and the thing is simply a fluff ball. It's by far the least heavy and the smallest of the planets, and its density is such that it has virtually no rock in it. A mixture, essentially, of frozen water, frozen ammonia, frozen methane, with very, very little water. So, you see that you have these really alien bodies by the standards of the inner solar system, bodies that are so different from the Earth and Venus and Mars as to make those three look like twin sisters. At least those are all made of the same substances. And try to imagine what the geology is going to look like, what the landscapes are going to look like on worlds that are so different from our own that they're not even made of the same thing. Finally, let me get back to the Galilean satellite. Io, the innermost, is in fact made of rock, and it shows no water whatsoever in its spectrum, not even water of hydration, that is to say, water that is chemically combined with the minerals that might otherwise form a surface. Europa, on the other hand, is made mostly of rock, but on the outside is ice. Europa is a world locked in the grip of a permanent global ice age. Its entire outer 200 miles is a gigantic sheet of planet-wide ice. And so Europa is mostly rock, but it's got some water. Ganymede is about half rock and half water, and only when you get out to Callisto do you find a terrestrial planet that is made of what you expect a terrestrial planet to be made of at that distance from the Sun, namely mostly frozen water. Apparently what happened is that Jupiter did the same thing to its moon as the Sun did to its planet. That is to say, boiled off the low boiling point materials from the nearer one. Jupiter was very hot, as I told you last week, when it formed, and there was a brief time there when the surface had a temperature of several hundred thousand degrees Fahrenheit, and that heat was not enough to vaporize rock 36 million miles away the way the Sun was able to do to Mercury, but it was enough to remove the water from Io and to remove a lot of the water from Europa and even some of it from Ganymede. And you've got to get all the way out to Callisto before you finally reach a body that was relatively unaffected by Jupiter's internal heat. So, this is what the terrestrial planets are made of. I think you can see the ones in the outer solar system are very bizarre by inner solar system standards, and we got the first detailed look of what some of them look like from Voyagers 1 and 2. There is Callisto. Callisto is the least geologically active body in the solar system, in the same way as Io is the most geologically active body in the solar system. It's a long list of what it isn't. It isn't basalt, which is a common dark lava. It isn't carbonaceous chondritic material, which is a common dark asteroidal material, and a lot of meteorites are made of that. In fact, the majority of meteorites are made of it, but most of them don't survive to reach the Earth's surface. It is not made of, well, those are the two most likely candidates one thinks of right off. And what it is made of, we can't tell. But Callisto, unlike, Callisto is more like our moon than the moon is. That is to say, the moon is not dead, as it is often incorrectly described. It is very much less geologically active than the Earth, but there are moonquakes, for example. The amount of seismic activity dissipated inside the Earth's moon in, say, a year is only a trillionth that is dissipated inside the Earth in the same period, but it is not zero. It is there. And gas has been detected coming out of the inside of the moon even after all these billions of years and so forth. The moon is not dead, and its youth, it was very, very active. 2 million square miles of its surface are flooded with lava that came out of the interior of the moon during a period that lasted about a billion years, centered on 3.5 billion years ago, and you can still see that material with the naked eye from the moon from the Earth today, from a quarter million miles away. It is the dark spots that form the face of the man in the moon. The lunar mare are the things the news media used to insist on calling seas during Apollo. And of course, that's a silly term. They're not seas. There's no water on the moon. Callisto never had any kind of internal geologic activity. The moon was born alive and died 3.5 billion years, about 3 billion years ago. Almost died. It's still twitching a little bit, but you know, geologically it is almost dead. Callisto was born dead and has remained dead ever since. And this is really weird. Callisto, the one of the Galilean satellites that is least like the Earth's moon as far as what it is made of is concerned, that is to say it's made of ice and not rock, is the one that has the surface that is the most like the Earth's moon, that is to say the surface is totally covered by features of exogenic rather than endogenic origin. Exogenic means a geologic feature, a topographic feature that has been formed by something from outside the planet, in this case a meteorite impact. Endogenic means a geologic feature which has been formed by processing from inside the planet, for example, a lava flow or a folded mountain range or sedimentary rock, the things that dominate the surface of the Earth. which before Voyager 1 was the most geologically active body known in the solar system. Calypso's entire surface is totally covered, completely saturated, with meteorite impact craters. And we know from the Apollo studies of the moon that most of those craters did not form steadily through geologic time. They formed in a relatively brief period of intense meteorite bombardment that occupied about the first billion years of the solar system's 4.5 billion year history. In other words, it was essentially finished by the time you got to 3.5 billion years ago. And so you are seeing very, very ancient features which have been preserved almost unchanged ever since practically the origin of the solar system, say 0.5 billion years, at most 1 billion years after the solar system formed. Is it reasonable to assume that a time scale that we got for our own moon applies this far away from home? If you mean to take it absolutely literally and use the exact same scale, no, of course it isn't. For one thing, some of those meteorites must have come from the asteroid belt. Callisto is a lot farther from the asteroid belt than our own moon is. On the other hand, some of them must have come from comets, and comets tend to get concentrated toward the sun and to hit harder because the sun's gravity is increasing as you move in toward the sun. But we do know that the rate of cratering on all the bodies in the inner solar system hasn't varied all that much. If you go from Mercury out to Mars, there isn't a terribly big variation in the appearance, the number of craters of a given size per square mile that formed during that crater bombardment period. And so there is some change, you know, but it's not great. And it seems very reasonable to extrapolate out to Callisto and say, well, if you've only got a change by a factor of, say, 4 or 5, if you go from Mercury to Mars, if you go about that same distance farther out, somewhat farther, and get out to Callisto, it is not reasonable to assume that all of a sudden you had a drop-off by a factor of 1,000, for example. So it's reasonable to assume that these craters that you're seeing here are typically 3, 4, 4.5 billion years old. On Callisto, there are 3 multi-ring basins, the very largest craters. There is what we now think is the crater itself, its central sort of amorphous region with relatively few superimposed smaller craters on top of it, which tells you that it's one of the youngest features still preserved for us on Callisto. And then surrounding that is ring after ring after ring after ring, where apparently the surface, the weak rock and ice surface, fractured as a result of the stress of the impact, and perhaps some of the purer ice from down below came up and filled in fractures, because you will notice that the rings appear white as though they were thin, and you will also notice the craters appear white, as though that dark rock material, or soil or whatever it is, maybe it's ground up rock, when I say rock I'm talking about composition only, as though that is a relatively thin layer, and if you excavate down into it a few miles, you can bring up the brighter ice that is down below. And that's one way you can tell that this is a picture of Callisto and not our own moon. Perhaps the most impressive way you can tell, though, is look how smooth the edge is. And look how two-dimensional those craters appear, almost as though they've been painted onto the surface. They don't show depressions in the center. They don't show raised walls around the edges. The way craters on the moon do. They look almost as though the whole surface had been put together in one of the relatively cheap science fiction thrillers where they tried to do a planet by just painting something and then having the model of a spacecraft fly past it, you know. Well, that could prove the Voyager 1 never really got there and the whole thing was fake in Hollywood, but an alternative explanation is that this is a relatively weak surface. It's rock mixed with ice, and there's a lot of ice there, and the ice probably dominates the structure of the surface. And it simply was not strong enough to be able to hold up over geologic time the weight of any reasonably high mountain, or to be able to keep open over geologic time the depression of any reasonably deep valley. There is a little bit of topography in Callisto. In the very, very highest resolution pictures, that is going to show the finest detail, you can see topography ups and downs of the order of a few hundred, up to 1,000 feet. But that's all. You don't have the many miles in depth that you have on the medium-sized craters on the moon. So Callisto is a body which has a weaker surface than the moon has, and over all those billions of years, the crater walls have flowed slightly and clumped down to not absolute flatness, but on a scale of picture like this, it's flat as far as you can tell. If you looked at the moon in a picture with this kind of scale, you would see all kinds of irregularities along the edges, which are the crater walls, the mountains, and so forth, superimposed against space. These multi-ring bases are very interesting bodies. This particular, very interesting object, rather. This particular one is the biggest of the three, and also happened to be the first one discovered. It is the biggest geographic feature in the solar system with a single origin. It is 1,800 miles in diameter. And that is, well, for example, the Pacific Ocean basin on the Earth is bigger, but it doesn't have a single origin. It's a bunch of individual plates, individual rock units with different origins. Question there, yeah. Okay, I figured somebody would ask that. The biggest crater that was known before this is the Hellas Basin on Mars, and that is 1,200 miles in diameter. This is 1,800 miles in diameter. The biggest crater on the Moon is the Imbrium Basin, 825 miles in diameter. The biggest crater on Mercury is the Orientale Basin, which is, I'm sorry, is the Caloris Basin, which is 850 miles in diameter. But that's comparing apples and oranges. There you are talking about the actual diameter of the crater itself. The hole that was dug as a result of the shock waves produced in the ground by the very, very intense catastrophic impact of a meteorite. If you are comparing that here, you're probably talking about just that innermost bullseye in the target. And that is only about 300 miles across, so it's not even as big as the largest crater on the Moon. In fact, there are 43 craters on the Moon that are bigger than that, as big as or bigger than that, or comparable to that. But you don't see any ring wall, of course, but you can see that it has that funny appearance to it, and we think that that is the crater ejecta, the material thrown out from the crater by the impact, most of which, on any planet, settles back inside the crater. Some of it, of course, gets thrown all over the landscape, but most of it settles back inside the crater, and then as the crater flattens, it produced that peculiar appearance in the bullseye. And what's happening is the ground has fractured, forming many, many, many rings. Now, in the very largest craters on the Moon and Mars and Mercury, you have the same sort of appearance. That is, you have multiple rings, and they are raised, they're mountainous, formed by fracturing of the ground as it failed as a result of the impact, and they surround the central crater like the rings of a bullseye. Yeah? That happens, too, as a matter of fact, but... not really. These things are so violent, and they are over so fast, and the forces dissipate so rapidly, that melting is relatively minor, and we went through intense arguments about that on the Moon, so I can speak with a great deal of confidence. The heat is so great at the time of impact that you vaporize a great deal of material, including the whole meteorite, by the way. So the meteorite is not to be found underneath the crater. But the heat dissipates so rapidly that what didn't get vaporized at the time of impact doesn't get affected at all to a very large extent. There's a little bit of melting. There's a thin zone there where it's heated enough to melt it, but not enough to vaporize it. But melting is a relatively minor phenomenon in impact crater formation. All I can say is you're trying to use your intuition, which is developed by forces that are so enormously less strong than what you're talking about here. Obviously, I mean, if you'd ever been through one of these, you know, anything as violent, you wouldn't have lived through it. You're trying to use your intuition to understand phenomena that are very much larger in scale than the way that intuition was developed. That's not useless by any means. There are a lot of good analogies you can make to crater formation by talking about what happens when you drop a stone into a pond. But you have to be very, very careful not to push it too far. Okay? For one thing, the forces are so strong that at the moment of impact and for a few seconds afterwards, it does not matter whether you're dealing with a solid or a liquid. It has essentially zero structural strength anyway compared to the forces that are acting on it. And so, for the first few seconds after impact, that material behaved as though it were a liquid. In fact, it behaved as though it were rarefied gas. It had less strength than that water that you throw the stone into, compared to the forces that were being imposed on it. But the forces also go away very rapidly, and there very rapidly comes a point where you have to start considering the structural strength. One thing that we can tell you, well, let me go back to what I was saying, and that is that the rings are much more numerous and much more closely spaced on this ice world than they are on the rock worlds, the Moon, Mercury, and Mars. And what that's telling us is that the strength of the surface in which they form and the strength of the surface that determines how large a unit of the surface could act, how large a block of the surface could act as a unit, okay, before it failed. The strength of the surface was less strong on this body, and that's why you have so many more of the rings. Imagine that you and I have hold of each one end of a piece of cheese, and we're pulling it apart. okay? It would fail in much the same way. It would break up into a series of blocks, right? And note, by the way, now here again, I'm just using an analogy from everyday experience. It's not necessarily safe, but in fact, it turns out this is an all right analogy. And note that the failure is not parallel to the direction of the force. It is perpendicular to the direction of the force, okay? And so the block of cheese would break into these small chunks. Well, doesn't it seem reasonable that the weaker the cheese, the closer together the pieces would be and the more fractures there would be, right? So you have the same sort of thing here. And what that tells you in turn is that these rings form at a time sufficiently far removed from the time of the impact itself that the forces had fallen to the point where the strength of the surface matters. And this is something we've been arguing about for some time in studying these multi-ring basins on the Moon and Mars. Did the outside rings form immediately at the same time as the impact crater itself? Or did they form a little bit later on when the ground finally failed as a result of the stress imposed in it? And now we know the answer to that question, at least for ice worlds, the answer is they form a little bit after. Now don't ask me if by a little bit after I mean 10 seconds after or 10 million years after. That we can't tell. But at least it was not simultaneously in time with the formation of the impact basin itself. Okay, am I going too fast? I don't want to discourage any questions. Yeah. The light is coming from the sun. Well, the infrared is coming from the sun. Solids do not give good spectra in the visible region. And so for many, many, many years, all the astronomy books said, you can only study the spectra of stars. For those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, spectrum is a way of treating the light or other radiation that comes from an object in a particular way that is too complex to go into here, but that gives you lots of useful information, including in many cases what it's made of. For many years, the astronomy books went on saying you can only study the spectra of gases, and that's true in the visible region. But in the last, about 10 years, astronomers have finally begun studying planets and moons in the infrared, fairly far out in the infrared, in fact. And it turns out that you do indeed have significant absorption at some wavelengths relative to others out there. You don't get the nice sharp lines that you're probably used to from the spectrum of a gas. You get these broad bands that cover hundreds, even thousands of angstroms, and you can go nuts trying to decide exactly where the center of the band is. But fortunately, there aren't all that many materials that are common constituents of the surfaces of planets and moons. And so by being a little judicious, by using the fact that we've got meteorites and they come from outer space and come from at least some of these bodies we're trying to study, for example, they come from the asteroid belt, by being a little bit clever about it, you can often identify the surface. In this particular case, it is a case where you cannot identify the surface. There are no bands, even in the infrared. Other questions? Real bright red spot, yeah, that's a characteristic kind of Voyager image or artifact, and whenever you see one of those, a red one, a blue one, or a green one, it's an artifact. This is a Voyager picture. I don't know how far the spacecraft was, probably several hundred thousand miles. That is one fantastically good camera, as I may have mentioned. And if they can do this in a couple hundred thousand miles, imagine what it's going to do with Titan next year when it gets 2,000 miles above the surface. The problem there is the spacecraft is moving fast enough, and the camera is so good that you're simply going to get a smear. Unless they can manage to move the camera while the spacecraft is moving so as to compensate for the image motion. That was a trick they eventually worked out for the Viking orbiters around Mars, but not the first time they tried it. The cameras are not really designed to be treated that way. And the last I heard, and this was a couple months ago, they were having these big worried debates about whether they dared try it on the Voyager flyby of Titan, where of course you have only one chance. You know, for an orbiter, you mess up the first try, wait until that place in the planet comes around and try again. But for a flyby, the question is, did the Viking people learn enough about how to do it by finally getting it right that the Voyager people will be able to get it right the first time? And if the Voyager people are able to get it right the first time, you will be able to see objects on the surface of Titan 20 feet across. If there is a surface. That's the other problem. At the moment, we think it's totally covered by clouds. I mean, yes, there is a surface. But the question is whether we can see it. So there may not be any point in trying to mess with that kind of resolution. And the real reason for going that close to Titan is not for pictures, it's for other data. Well, if you had any doubt in your mind from this picture that the statement that I made that Callisto's surface is totally covered by craters is correct, let me show you another picture taken by Voyager 2, specially computer processed to bring out the craters. This one has been computer processed mainly to bring out the brightness differences and the very subtle color differences. As you can see, there's not much of a lag. But here comes one that's been processed to bring out the craters, and I think you'll be convinced. That is what is meant by the word saturated. But if you look at it, you'll notice that all the craters seem to be pretty small. You have a very few of these multi-ring bases. There's another one. A little bit out of focus there. This slide projector doesn't want to focus every part of the slide simultaneously. But you can see the multi-ring basin down there. You notice in this computer processing, it doesn't show up nearly as strongly. You gain some to lose some. But you can certainly see there are lots and lots of craters, but all of them seem to be small. If you look at the moon, there'd be plenty of craters that say that size, that would be 30 miles across. But there'd also be plenty of craters 100 miles across and 300 miles across and so on. And those things are missing here. Well, they're not. They just look that way. I mean, they're missing in the picture. But there's no reason to assume that they were missing on Callisto. If a crater like that formed, the meteorite that formed it was, of course, bigger than the ones that formed the smaller craters. And that means that it was less abundant. The bigger ones are less common than the little ones, which means that since the number of impacting bodies, of meteorites, was large at the beginning of the solar system's history and then fell off rapidly, it is much more likely for a crater of any size to have formed early than late. Okay, there are more old ones of any given size than young ones. But if the small craters are sufficiently numerous to totally cover the surface, then the old small craters are going to get obliterated by younger small craters which have formed on top of them, okay? And the old large craters are going to get covered by younger small craters. And that indeed is true on the moon. But you say, now wait a minute, we can see all of these old large craters on the moon. How come? Answer? Although they are almost totally covered by overlapping younger small craters, the hole is still there. Okay? What you have is a hole in the ground which tells you there was a big crater there, even though it's totally covered by younger small craters. On Callisto, the holes in the ground have gone away because of the cold flow. And so the old large craters are not visible, and the only large craters you do see are these three at the centers of the multi-ring basin structures, which, note please, are the youngest features on Callisto, at least the youngest regions of their size, as indicated by the number of overlapping younger small craters that are on top of them. Probably were a lot more of those multi-ring structures once, and they're gone now, having been destroyed by these later impacts. Ganymede. There is a Voyager 1 image of Ganymede. I remember telling Kelly Bailey, the space editor of Science Telescope, who was covering the mission for that magazine, I said, if you print this picture in black and white, everybody's going to say it looks just like the moon. And if you print it in color, nobody's going to say that. Because it does have this division into large dark areas and bright areas, which superficially, if you don't know your way around the moon very well, might look lunar. In fact, if you know your way around the moon, that does not look like the moon even black and white. But with that color, there's no question. Notice that the polar regions, this is the equator lines over here, there's the North Pole, there's the South Pole, the polar regions are blue, and then there's an equatorial region which is bronze. Some people thought that was a camera artifact from Voyager 1, but Voyager 2 confirmed it. Okay, back to the Voyager 1 picture for a moment. What you see is a surface that is divided into large regions of some dark stuff, and those are separated from one another, they're roughly polygonal, irregular polygons in shape. Those are separated from one another by these long linear tracks of this lighter stuff, and then superimposed on both of them are the youngest craters, the ones presumably that light, that bright stuff, the ones whose ejecta blankets have not been destroyed yet by younger superimposed small craters. Just as on our own moon, where a meteorite forms and dust is kicked out in all directions and it forms bright rays, but the rays are then later destroyed, and so only the youngest craters, in the case of our own moon, that means less than 2 billion years in age, and remember, most of them are much older than that, so only a relatively small percentage of that young on our own moon, only the, all the demonstrators show the rays, and they do the same sort of thing in Callisto, except that the white stuff here is not rock, but ice. On Callisto, you can see you've got about half the surface made of rock and about half the surface made of ice, and that is in accordance with the Earth-based spectral observations. The rock may be the same material as that dark stuff on Callisto. It shows the same lack of spectral characteristics, but of course, if all you can say about it is you can't see any features, then, you know, you can't say it's the same featureless stuff. All I can say is it's featureless stuff. The Voyager 1 pictures showed this side of Ganymede, which is roughly the side that faces toward Jupiter. This is the biggest of the Galilean satellites, and the central meridian that sees in Jupiter runs about through there. So this is about the side that you would see if you were floating up above the clouds of Jupiter looking up at the sky. The other side was photographed by Voyager 2. And among other things, these pictures show the largest of these regions of dark material, and these are heavily cratered and look very much like Callisto. It's the brighter stripes in between them that are the features that are unique to Ganymede, and I'll tell you about in a moment. But what's interesting, so what you've got, this is, the dark things are heavily cratered on the inside. If I had a computer processed picture that was like that one I showed you two slides back, it would look very much as though a chunk of Callisto had been plastered onto the surface of Ganymede there. So these are the oldest features on Ganymede. But these younger things show very few superimposed craters. You can see they show some, and of course, since the white ones are the most obvious, it may be less obvious from where you're sitting than it will be when you see more detailed pictures, but there are many, many fewer craters in the bright areas than there are in the dark areas. But in this particular dark area, the largest of them all, it preserved the remnants of a Callisto-style multi-ringed basin, which must have been, when it first formed, by far the largest geographic object in the solar system, dwarfing even that 1,800-mile one on Callisto. When you look at the curvature of those rings, the center of that basin must have been all the way around there. You see, nothing is preserved of it. Unfortunately, it's been chewed up by this younger stuff. But that basin must have been almost 5,000 miles in diameter of its outermost ring, which means that when it was whole, in an early stage of Ganymede's history, it covered an entire hemisphere of Ganymede. We have never seen any other world on which there is a single geographic structure that covers an entire hemisphere. But yeah. No, if you calculate the size of the innermost basin compared to the size of the rings there, this one, assuming that the ratio of the size of the basin to the size of the outermost ring is the same on Ganymede as on Callisto, which is probably a semi-safe kind of interpretation, you get a crater about 600 miles across. Again, smaller than any on the moon. It's interesting, by the way, I only have time to mention this peripherally because to do a proper treatment of it will take more time than we've got, but it's interesting that none of the Galilean satellites show a crater that's anything like just below the size that would have broken it up, as do all of the bodies in the inner solar system whose surfaces are old enough to show craters at all, with the single exception of Deimos, the outer moon of Mars. Phobos shows one, Deimos does not. So there may be more to it than, gee, isn't it a strange coincidence, and maybe all these moons are small population survivors and so on. But anyway, let's talk about what the bright side is. Spacing of those rings is only half what it is on Callisto, which implies that at the time that this multi-ring basin formed, which was earlier than the time that this younger terrain in between the dark areas formed, Ganymede's surface was even weaker than Callisto. And as we shall see, it rigidified rapidly. There are three different ages of terrain on Ganymede. All of them are very ancient. Even the youngest one shows almost as many superimposed craters as the oldest regions of the moon surface, our own moon surface. And yet, they show very, very different degrees of topography. There's virtually no topography in the dark regions. It's very Callisto-like in that respect as well. You have topography a few hundred meters in height in these regions, and in the youngest regions, which are mountainous areas that were small mountainous areas that were discovered by Voyager 2, you have topography all the way up to a couple of kilometers. And yet, even that is very old. And so the surface rapidly rigidifies. Okay? It rigidified, which is to say it was able to hold up higher and higher mountains, and it did so rapidly because even the youngest of those mountains are very old. here is what those interior regions look like, the bright regions look like. And as you can see, they are made of what looks like cloud ground. You have these intricate, convoluted series of furrows and grooves, which look, well, there was a big argument in the press room between the California types who insisted that they look like dune buggy tracks, and those of us in the colder climes who knew that in fact they were made by snowmobiles. And, you know, you had this big argument about whether they called the snowmobile track or dune buggy track. But at the time that, at the time Voyager 1 discovered these, this is a Voyager 2 picture, but at the time Voyager 1 discovered them, it was taken for granted by most of the geologists out there, certainly the ones that breathed up, that they were simply giant fault zones. We have now advanced. We do not know what they are. Unfortunately, there is not any sign of fault motion along most of them in the sense of seeing something that has been cut in two by the fault and the two parts have been moved to the side. And we just don't know what they are, but it looks as though something, some process that forced material up perhaps into cracks under the ground has eaten its way systematically up into large areas of Ganymede and destroyed the ancient craters as it did so. I think you can see on this picture much more clearly the difference in number of craters per square mile in the dark areas and in the bright areas. There are craters in the bright areas, there are many of them, but there aren't as many as there are in the dark areas, and that's what I mean by saying that these bright areas are younger. If you are not convinced from this picture, which was taken with the sun fairly high in the sky from that part of Ganymede, and therefore the features not showing very good shadows, if you are not convinced in this picture that those are in fact grooves and furrows, try this one taking near the shadow edge, and I think you'll be convinced. Notice, by the way, that all of the grooved terrain is younger than the crater. I'm sorry, is older than the craters that are superimposed on it. In other words, all of the ancient craters were destroyed by whatever process produced the grooved terrain. And the only craters that you see today are those that formed on it after whatever that process was had stopped. Europa. There is a world locked in the grip of a permanent global ice age. This is the best picture of it that was taken by Voyager 1. That was taken from a considerable distance. Europa was the only one that Voyager 2 did, and the Voyager 1 did not get close to. Voyager 2, however, got very much closer to it, and I'll show you Voyager 2 pictures in a moment. Let me point out, though, these very interesting features here. The grooves, or lines, rather, which you see all over Europa, and which caused one of the more knowledgeable reporters, one of the few knowledgeable reporters, in the press room at the time Voyager 1 sent back to